This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Mira Tsivasodi. Dato' Dr. Mazlan Othman is Malaysia's first astrophysicist. She helped establish astronomy courses in Malaysian universities, the Malaysian Space Science Studies Division, the first National Planetarium of Malaysia, the National Microsatellite Program, and the National Space Center, as well as the Langkawi National Observatory. In 1999, she was appointed by the United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan to head the UN Office for Outer Space Affairs, and she continued in that role till 2013. She's now the project director of something called Mega Science for Academy Sciences Malaysia, and she's in the studio with us after, you know, such a long time of me trying to get her and, you know, get her in for an interview to understand her work. Welcome to the show, Dato. How are you today?
Yes, hello, Mira.
It's been a pleasure. You've been in Vienna for a very long time. You want to just go through with me what you actually did in your capacity at the United Nations?
In that capacity in the United Nations,
yes.
I was the director of the Office for Outer Space Affairs. And normally people ask me, what would a typical day be like? Actually, a typical day would be me acting mainly as a diplomat and looking at the politics of the various countries. And so I was not really an astrophysicist anymore when I was in the United Nations, but acting as a diplomat.
How did your journey as an astrophysicist actually start?
Well, I suppose it started in school when I fell in love with physics. And as a result of my passion for physics, I did my first degree in physics in New Zealand at the University of Otago. And during that time, I discovered astrophysics or astronomy. And unlike today, when books and everything else on astronomy and astrophysics is so pervasive, there were no books. You know, I don't recall that the books in the library in my school had anything on astronomy. But I discovered it in the university. And then I realized that of all the physics fields, because there's I could do quantum mechanics, I could do solid state physics or nuclear physics, that astrophysics was really the field for me because it had philosophy in it, a lot of aesthetics in terms of the beauty in the universe. And that was what inspired me most.
But I understand your passion was more in literature and the arts.
Yes, yes. Initially when I was young, yeah, I loved English literature and art. I'm not saying I regret it for those young people out there. I don't regret it because today I'm still can do lots of things for the arts in various capacities.
Who would have thought, right? The astrophysicist in arts and, you know, how does that, you know, when you think of an astrophysicist, it's all about science. And they do say science is the arts and arts is actually the science. How do you connect with that?
Well, okay, before I connect that, I would like to say that the reason why you're asking me this question is because there's a disconnect in our education system. And that is one of the first things that we must address very
aggressively.
Because you can see the education system in other countries, they don't make this very, very strict distinction. But everything that you see, even as a scientist, if you're going to be designing your experiment or whatever, there is always some aesthetics there, although you're not aware of it. But as I said before, astrophysics is one of those fantastic fields that actually consists of objects and items that are so aesthetically mind-blowing or mind-boggling. Just open any astronomy book and it will blow your mind. Yeah. Even the best artists in the world could not imagine what God created for us out there.
But correct me if I'm wrong, science has never been a priority in this country. How do we make it more sexy? For the
science
lack of a better word.
More sexy. I think science has been priority in this country. Like, as an example, we have the Ministry of Science, you know, not just the Ministry of Agriculture, Ministry of Science, Technology and Innovation. We've got the Academy of Sciences, and there's, and through MOSTI, the ministry, there's been a fair amount, and I would say a respectable amount of funding going for research, much more than research for the humanities, for instance. So if you look at the amount of money, funds spent on science and technology versus humanities, oh, the difference is so marked. So I would disagree with you if in those terms you say that there is no priority in science. But what happens is that, and this is the sad thing, that the scientists do not are not projected as role models, or people don't admire scientists for some reason. But they would admire Siti Nurhaliza. But they wouldn't admire somebody who's won an award, a Torrey Award or something like that.
It's our priorities, really.
Yeah, the closest I got to competing with Siti Nurhaliza was when we had Sheikh Muzaffar. There was one time they did a poll, you know, people had to vote whom they thought was the most popular. And there were a few months when Sheikh Muzaffar's ranking overcame Siti Nurhaliza's ranking. And I thought, oh, I've done it.
You were, you know, the one who initiated the Angkasawan program.
Yes.
What made you, what inspired you? What made you think that we needed to send somebody up to the International Space Station?
And everybody says it's a waste of money and all that. But when I came back from Vienna and formed the agency, the National Space Agency, the people of the media, people like yourselves, you know, kept asking me, now that we have a space agency, aren't we going to send a Malaysian to space? And the first few times I said, no, we're not going there, because we're going to build satellites, etc., etc., and it's going to benefit the country and whatnot. And so you can see, you know, the eyes glaze over and this goes above their heads. The next two or three times is the same thing. And then I start asking myself, Mira, I must be missing something here. Why is the public and why is the media asking me this question? Then I realized that you cannot relate to a satellite. Well, I can, but you can't.
You
and the
are
public
right.
cannot.
Yeah.
But what would you and the public relate to? A person. It's the person.
Yeah.
It's the astronaut. That's
correct.
Why they wanted to see a Malaysian in space. And so the next time I met Mahathir, I asked him. I said, I've been asked this question so many times, you know, so give me a clue. Tell me, you know, how I should be addressing this. And he said to me, from this country, from time to time, we need a project that unifies all the people in the country, no matter what your economic status is, your education, your race, or whatever, you know. This you have to unite them. And then you need to have something that inspires people. Particularly, he says, we need to inspire young people. And he says, the astronaut program is one of those. And we should be thinking of that. And then the whole conversation just went from there, you know. And that's how we set up we decided to have someone fly into space. But then, that's just about this short term where we're talking about unifying, inspiring, and aspiring for excellence and all that. That's fine. But actually, Mira, I had an even longer term view of that. You know, if you ask the space people, NASA, ESA, the Russian Space Agency, they will tell you that the people who are going to set foot on Mars are already born. So which means that it's in another 30-35 mm-hmm. years, they failed to launch that spacecraft that would take this astronauts. But, you know, failures happen all the time. But they're already thinking of the spacecraft that will take humans to Mars. But the point I'm making is, in another 30 to 35 years, we'll have people going to Mars. And I thought to myself, for sure, that team will not be totally American, because there's no one country that can really take on the resources, will have all the resources to do that huge expedition. And it will be an international team. And I thought, wouldn't it be so cool if we had a Malaysian on that in that team. Then I thought to myself, oh, there's never going to be a Malaysian on this team because we're not in it. You know, nobody will look at us or look at us for, say, candidates.
Yeah.
And I thought to myself, you know what? We have to do it in a little way. We're not going to launch our own rockets, but if we could get involved in the manned space program, then next time when there is an international search for an astronaut, they say, oh, you know what? Malaysia, they had an astronaut. They must have the capability and the capacity to send, to give us a candidate who could be chosen. But if we never did that, Mira, nobody would look at us.
Right.
Nobody.
And as you mentioned, a lot of Malaysians felt it was a waste of taxpayers' money. Was that really the case?
To me, it depends on what you think is a waste in terms of the quantum, okay? But I know that somewhere in the virtual, in the internet out there, people are saying that the program cost 100 or 150 million ringgit or dollars. I'm not sure. I need to correct that because we did not pay for the launch, nor did we pay, or we did not pay for the training, nor did we pay for the launch, which if you go to the market, would cost, say, 25 million US dollars because the US dollars fluctuates. And that would have been the market price. But we did not pay for that. What we did pay was for the astronaut to carry out science experiments. That was a separate project we negotiated with the Russians. And that would have cost anywhere between 11 to 12 million ringgit. And that was to do the science. So I would love to have everybody correct this, that we did not spend hundreds of millions of ringgit or dollars.
We'll come back up next and find out more about the experiments that were carried out. That was also given some bad press as to the relevance of many of those experiments. Mm-hmm. Coming up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon, I'm Mira Sivasuthi. Dato' Dr. Mazlan Othman, Project Director of Megascience Academy Scientist Malaysia, is in the studio with me. She's no other than Malaysia's first astrophysicist, no stranger to the world. She's, you know, served in a capacity in the United Nations from 1999 to 2013. Now, Dato', you're the Project Director of Megascience.
Yes.
What is that?
Megascience essentially looks at what we would like the nation to be in 2050, but essentially leveraging on science and technology interventions. So what this means is that we need to be able to predict already from now what's going to happen to the world and to Malaysia in 2050 and put in place the plans to get there. And what would those plans be? They would be research and development. We also have to identify what are the new niche areas in the new, I would say, niche economic areas. And also, I think we need to be thinking of we as a society, how are we going to get there? So it's the science, it's the economics, and also the societal aspects of getting to 2050.
I think sometimes, Dato', we fail to understand the larger picture as far as the impact of science is concerned on the ordinary person. How would you help us understand that?
You look around, I mean, you look around the studio, it's all science and technology.
I think the problem is we just take it for granted.
Right, right. Yeah. You look at your watch even.
Yep.
That's many thousands of years of observation by the astronomers before you could have a watch. Don't talk about the internet, you know. But I think why is science and technology important is because it's going to affect your life. I don't like to use the word transform because sometimes people, you know, they misconstrue this. But really, science and technology can transform your life. And which is why looking at science and technology and what that's going to be in 2050 is one of the most important things that needs to be done. Because you can say, oh, I don't want to look at science and technology, I just want to look at society in 2050. You can't do that. You must know what the science and advancements in science technology are going to be. And that's how important science and technology is.
But in such a wide area. You know, 2050 is not very long. You know, it's not very far away from us.
No, I'm glad you say it's not very far away. Everybody I've met says, oh, 2050, no, that's 36 years from now.
We always thought 2020 was far away. It's, you know, five years away from us now.
It's just around the corner
It is. It is indeed. So what areas are we actually going to focus on?
Okay.
Without replicating what other people have already done.
Okay. You know, you have to not think that replicating is necessarily bad, Mira, because we all want to do the same things, really. And you might have to replicate some. But, you know, apart from that, in going to 2050, you've got to think, and I say this many, many times, you've got to have an idea, you've got to have a vision of what that society is going to be. What would you and I be doing, say, in 2050, in terms of our work, etc. And in terms of looking at that, we came up with the idea that what we all want to be and should be in 2050 is to be a smart, to be part of a smart community. Okay, once we've decided that we're going to be a smart community, the attributes of such a community will be that we are harmonious, we are prosperous, and we are supported by green technology. That would make us a smart community. But of course, this smart community cannot exist just like that. What makes us prosperous is that we need the economic engine to work for us and things like that. So, but again, there is this ecosystem that supports this smart community, and you need good health. You need to be safe. You need a transportation system that's friendly. Those kind of things. So that's the ecosystem that makes the community smart. And then I said, underlying all of this is we must have jobs. Huh? We must create wealth. But all of this will be for naught if we do not have a good governance system, our regulations, our laws, our policies, because they will enable the whole system to actually be created or to happen. So this is how we see Mega Science 3 and where we're going with 2050.
What are you working with at the moment? Is it a fragmented scientific community?
Yes, yes. So I feel that a lot of the time we are working in silos.
Yeah.
But by having that societal context that I told you about, it should make all our thoughts converge. So it doesn't matter whether you're in the automotive industry. What do you have to do in the automotive industry that will support a smart community? What do you have to do in, let's say, the furniture that will make the community smart? So then when we look at it that way, we'll have to interweave everything that we do, automotive with transportation, with infrastructure, all of which will support this smart community. And then that this forces us to get out of our silos and work horizontally.
And that is the scientific community. What about the ordinary Malaysian in terms of mindset? I mean, you have infrastructure technology racing ahead, but mindsets need to keep, you know, in par with what's actually going on. I mean, you can look at infrastructure that we have. We have some of the best infrastructure in the world.
Yes.
But mindset-wise, we're still not ready to make the best of it. So it needs to work concurrently. And how do we do that?
I think the problem with the mindset is that people take things for granted. And they feel that whatever they do, things are going to be there. That's one. The other is there's a lack of awareness about who we are, where we are, in the scheme of things.
Our sense of identity.
Yes, yes. Because if you think of where you are, what you are, you'll very quickly discover that you cannot have a day without internet. You cannot have a day without satellites. You cannot have a day without the clocks or something like that, you know, without energy. And if you realize that, then you know how important science and technology is and how important it has been in advancing the world's civilizations. Even if we talk about the older civilizations, Maya or whatever, they were reliant on some kind of science and technology without calling it science and technology, of course.
Does this mean with this program at Megascience, we would possibly see the second space outing for Malaysia?
Second space outing, meaning second astronaut?
Yes.
I wasn't thinking of that, but yeah, why ever not? The only thing is that if we're going to have a second astronaut, he or she cannot be doing the same thing that Sheikh Muzaffar did. Now, you remember, as I said, the whole idea of the first Angkasawan program is to create an awareness of space and of science to inspire and to aspire. To inspire and aspire for excellence and unify the people in many ways. That's done. So, as people say, been there, done it. Okay, so if you're going to have a second Angkasawan, you have to go beyond that. You have to go beyond the science that Sheikh Muzaffar did at that time. So to me, what would that be? That would be if Malaysia or some Malaysian or some organisation in Malaysia had a very unique or niche technology, say, to propose and to test in space. I'll give you an example. Canada is not doesn't have a big budget in space, but they are one of the most important players there, despite US spending billions and the Europeans spending billions, and the Japanese too, and the Russians. But everybody relies on the Canadians for what? For what they call the Canadian arm. So if you go to the International Space Station, it was at the shuttle too. There is this arm that looks like this, you know, where you can grasp things. You can grasp old satellites or grasp whatever.
Like a robotic arm.
Yeah, a robotic arm. And nobody thought about this arm. But the Canadians came up with this technology, and it wasn't even very expensive to develop. Now, we Malaysians need to be thinking in those lines. What can we bring to the space station that other people have not thought about, but it's not going to cost us $10 billion to develop? You see, the best ideas are not necessarily the most expensive. But until we have that, I find it hard to rationalize why we need to go to space a second time.
It's been 7 years since our first Angkasawan went to this space station. Of course, some of the experiments he carried out at the space station also, you know, came under fire, Dr. Maslan. I mean, what's your defense for that? Or maybe it's all of us not understanding this whole mission enough.
I think people misunderstand what it is you can do in space. When I sent out the, for proposals, I asked people to present to me or to apply their projects, to propose projects that could be carried out at the International Space Station, and they come up with cure for cancer, cure for AIDS, you know, but that's not the way you do science in the International Space Station. Because what's unique about the International Space Station is its lack of gravity, and so you need to have a project where you can see that it's working this way on Earth with gravity. How will this function and make me understand the features, the theory, whatever, better if I brought this to space? Now, there's always just incremental steps to this. So you're not going to be able to cure cancer or AIDS just because you went to space once. I mean, we're not even going to space 20 times like the Americans, just the once, and we cannot expect to be, as I said, to cure everything in the world. So we took small steps. But the important thing is our scientists had to think outside the box. I know this is a cliche, but you really had to think quite uniquely, because if here you take let's say, a beaker, there's a chemical, you take a spoon and you stir it. Nothing of that will work in space. You cannot stir it because the water is going all over the place, and the spoon will go all over the place. You know, so you have to be thinking: if I'm carrying on an experiment and I need to stir the chemicals, how is that going to happen in space?
What were we trying to tell Malaysians when we decided to take Teh Tarik into the space station?
Teh Tarik, as I said, people thought what a banal, idle idea this was, you know, and that we shouldn't be doing talking about Teh Tarik in space. But you see, the whole idea of Teh Tarik is this. if you look at the action of pulling your tea, you actually pull the water in space.
Yeah.
Now, what I wanted people to think about was, can you actually pull this water in space? The tarik bit. Then you find that, no, you cannot tarik tea in space. Why? Because we're under microgravity conditions and you can actually see the water float and how it coats the spoon. You know, all kinds of physics comes into it. But the most important thing that would have happened is the millions of people who drink teh tarik in some mama stall or even at home, you know, they'll be talking about teh in space. And then, hopefully, they'll be discussing, why not? Why can't we have teh tarik? And so, to me, science is not about catering to the very elite scientists. Science must go down to the ground. And that's where I thought the teh tarik concept would have caught everybody's attention, because they'll say, okay, let's see what's going to happen to this teh tarik. But of course, everybody gave it a bad name and decided that we were too sophisticated, we were too scientific to talk about something like that, because they forget that the program is also for the people on the street. And to me, they were more important than the elitist scientists.
There was also an element of culture as well.
Yes, culture. Yep, mm-hmm. Yep.
Which, you know, a lot of other countries have taken up to the space station.
Every country that's gone to space has always projected or promoted some form of their culture.
Dr. Maslan, did you watch the movie Interstellar?
I did.
Oh,
now I can answer that
question. Yes, please. And what did you think of it?
Well, I thought it was a little long in the beginning.
Close to 3 hours.
Yes. But I think the actors played their parts very well. But what about the science, you know?
Yes.
This idea of the wormhole and all that is, of course, one of the best ideas we have today if we wanted to travel through other stars, because most of the stars are many millions of light years away. So if we just go by the normal physical space, like going by bus somewhere, we will never make it. So I think if somebody saw the movie, the wormhole actually allows you to take a shortcut. And that's a theory that's quite well accepted.
But do movies like Interstellar sort of detract from the evolution of thinking?
No, no.
It doesn't
think, because it allows you to ask the question, is this true or not? And I was told, and I've seen it, that with Interstellar, there was a book written on the physics of, you know, the what happened, of the issues in the movie itself. And I think that's good, because to me, anything that attracts the public, not the scientists, people on the street, to read a passage even, let alone a book, is fantastic, because it's not easy to engage people these days, the young, you know. You have to do something really dramatic to engage young people. So if they're going to read a passage and talk about wormholes because you're going to see this movie, good.
When we come back, we'll find out more about whether Dr. Maslan feels we have an obsession of finding biological life elsewhere. Up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. It's The Bigger Picture and I'm Mira Sivasuthi. In the studio with me, Malaysia's first astrophysicist, Dr. Maslan Othman. She's now the project director of Megascience from the Academy Sciences Malaysia. She's, of course, started our first Angkasa One program. She's done a whole load of work as far as astrophysics is concerned in this country. Extremely proud of her. I mean, I've been waiting ages for this moment to actually meet her and interview her. You know, Dr. Maslan, do we have an obsession for biological life elsewhere?
Yes, I think people talk about UFOs in that context because they like to think that there's life elsewhere, and people like to talk about aliens. Unfortunately, everybody thinks aliens should look exactly like us. then, you know, the question is, should we be talking about life outside of the Earth? Now, if you asked me this question, say, about 15 years ago, this was still what I call a giggle. There's a giggle factor in that, because everybody did not believe that there is life outside of the Earth. But today we have fields called astrobiology and many, and you know, astrogeology and stuff like that, that actually looks at the conditions that would support life outside of the Earth. And so the question is, should there be life outside of Earth? I would say with an absolute yes, there should be life outside of Earth. Because if you look at the statistics, if we say that life must occur on a planet, okay, a planet must go around a star. How many stars are there in our galaxy alone? You know, it's 10, and then you add about 24 zeros there.
Yeah.
And then you add, then you tell, you ask yourself, how many galaxies are there? And then 10 with the 24 zeros, you add another 30 zeros, and that's the number of galaxies. So it's a heck of a lot of zeros. So if you're going to think that the probability of it happening is like 0.000, whatever how many zeros, 1%, it is still not zero. It is maybe not huge, but it is not zero.
Mm-hmm.
And so just statistically, we should, there should be life and, apart from on the Earth. But then again, the next question is, what do you define as life? Okay, let's not be like Stephen Hawking where he says computers. In the end, robots can be defined as life because they must be able to replicate in the future. That's 2050, okay? But we're not there yet. When, if we restrict ourselves, if we talk about life only as you and I with nose, you know, ears and walking or whatnot, we should not do that because life can exist in a unicellular form like the bacteria. And of course, and this is what has made this this study of astrophysics a lot more exciting, is because we have discovered life in totally improbable situations, like in the vents of volcanoes, many kilometers under the ice of Antarctica, for instance. You know, I'm talking about two extreme conditions. So if they can exist in those extreme conditions, they must also be able to exist in the extreme conditions that are on the planets or on the moons of other stars. And so, yeah, if you look at life that way, there should be life outside of our planet.
As Malaysia's first astrophysicist, I mean, have you not want to just jump onto that or be a part of the space program and go up to the space station yourself?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you set up all of this.
I wouldn't bat an eyelid if you somebody walked through this door today and said, okay, Mazlan, we're looking for people to go on Mars.
And why haven't you done it yet?
One-way trip, never coming back. And I say, okay, show me. I don't even have to take my clothes, you know. Why haven't I done that?
Yeah.
Well, this is a little bit interesting because when we launched the astronaut program, I thought maybe I might just put myself in the mix and see whether I would qualify. But the minister in charge of the program then, which was Dato' Sri Najib, insisted that I should manage the whole program. The director of the project director. So, you know, as the project director, I had to immediately disqualify myself. So, yeah, sure, but I still want to be
I'm sure.
Somewhere.
Do you think opportunity
person.
Could come knocking? You
sure.
know, I mean, you were with the United Nations. You could have joined anyone, really, on a space mission.
No.
Why not?
Because you had to have, you must come from a country. It is all of these people represent their countries and whatnot. So when you see a European in space, although he or she is, say, from the European Space Agency, actually they are Italians or Germans. Lately, this is German lady who went to space. Now, the whole process of selecting her in Germany, you know, was huge. And so even in places like that where you think, oh, space travel should be mundane, who cares, you know, who's being selected? Not true. Spain or wherever, when they select the astronaut, it's a big deal.
You know,
always a big deal.
2050 is, as I said, not a very long time. What are some of the challenges that you foresee in taking us to 2050?
Okay, 2050. Everybody's, as I said, I'm glad you don't have any fear of going to 2050. A lot of people are, simply because it's very difficult to predict what's going to happen in 2050. But I always say that whatever it is, we decide in Malaysia, the world is going to get there. We're going to be taken there kicking and screaming, or are we going to be taken there with a well-thought plan? And I think we have the chance now to go there with a well-thought plan because we are well aware now of what's happening in the world. We have experts who can help us, or we too can be those experts. So the time is right to be thinking of 2050, definitely. But what are the challenges? The challenges would be, okay, before I talk about the challenges, the easiest thing that people in the academy can do, people like me, for instance, is to do the technology foresight. That's quite not straightforward, but it's doable. You know, we know that we are here in nanotechnology, here in neuroscience, bioscience, green technology. We expect to get there, provided we assume that there'll be no pandemics, no major disasters or whatever. That's where we're going to go. What is more difficult, the biggest challenge of all, are the socio-economic elements. Now, just because we can do genetic engineering, for instance, where we can, when the child is in the mother's womb, we can actually do things. Or we can have cosmetic brain surgery where it can make you cleverer and things like that. And we have to ask ourselves, what do you want to be in 2050 in those kind of areas? Remembering we have our ethics, our religion, our morality, all those things. But that is the real challenge, not getting there in terms of the science and technology.
Mindsets, once again. Yeah. You presented at the National Sciences Academy's Mega Science 2050 Forum. Mm. What should be on Malaysia's agenda going into 2050?
You've caught me there because there are so many things. But as I said to you, the most important thing is what is that aim? I mean, at the heart of all of this, what is it that we want to become, what the nation wants to become? And I've said it so many times that we think that as an aim, as a goal, we should be wanting to become people living in smart communities. And that's where we want to be.
What would you
that's
like?
That's the end game.
You know, what would you like your legacy to be?
I'm very scared about talking about legacy because
Pandang.
I think people who leave legacies are people like Nelson Mandela, you know.
You will always remain in my mind, that's for sure.
A legacy, you know, I, of course, I've left all this. Created all those things in the space arena. And I think now that I've sort of retired, well, you know, some of us, retire later than others, is I think I'd like to have Malaysians feel that they can be in control of the future, which is why I'm so excited about this project. Whatever you're talking about, you know, education, you're talking about with everybody, everybody seems to be not in control of how they see the future. But if we can provide a methodology for looking forward, a framework for looking forward, I think people might be more optimistic. I like to show this picture where normally you see this slightly mad person saying the end is near. And it's very easy for us to talk about the end, you know, Kiamat, the Malays, like the Muslims and whatnot. And some cult will say it's the end of the world, we're going to this asteroid or whatever. But actually, we don't have to fear future at all, because everything you see around you is what the future is already, everything around you is already showing you what the future is going to be. The internet and the way we, the way we entertain ourselves, some elements are already here. So I always say, instead of the end is near, I like to say the future is here. And you know, it's in the face and we must look into the future.
Thank you very much for joining us today. That's Dr. Mazlan Othman, Project Director of Megascience, Academy Sciences Malaysia, Malaysia's first astrophysicist on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.